Welcome to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later, where we research the response of our past and review their relevance for today. This is your host, Moshe Kurtz. Welcome to another episode of Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. We have the privilege today to be joined by Rabbi Gideon Rothstein, who will be talking about a very important tshuva of the Tzitz Eliezer of Eliezer Waldenberg, about the parameters and the limitations on the principle of confidentiality, primarily in the medical context, but perhaps we'll discuss even beyond the medical context. Now, Rabbi Gideon Rothstein has served in the communal rabbinate and has taught all levels of Jewish education. He's the author of Jewishly themed fiction and nonfiction, including Murder in the Mikdash, a murder mystery set in the time of the Third Temple. And We're Missing the Point, a discussion of what should characterize Orthodox Jewish lives. And of course, Judaism of the Poskim is his most recent book, and that is what has certainly caught my interest. For those seeing it on video, he's holding it right up, which is a sefer on Shiloh and Shuvos for every day of the year. And I thought to myself, when I'm thinking of who to invite to bring on this podcast, I would be remiss if I didn't have someone such as yourself who has a specialty and a similar passion for Shiloh and Shuvos. I couldn't think of a more appropriate pick. So I thank you for joining us today. And also I thank you for being actually our first guest who's going to share a tshuva of the Tzitz Eliezer. So before we even jump into the question, maybe just tell us who the Tzitz Eliezer is, and how this topic is actually very apropos and right up his alley.
So the Tzitz Eliezer was Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg. He's born in Yerushalayim, and other than in 1916, and then other than a couple of years where he was a rabbi in the Tanya, I think, he spends his whole life in Jerusalem, and he's a rabbi. He's a rabbi on rabbinic courts. He's an important rabbi, and he also becomes the posek, the halachic decisor for Shari Tzedek Hospital. So he doesn't only answer medical questions, but he answers many, many medical questions, because the director of Shari Tzedek would ask him questions. I found those, you know, random doctors would ask questions. It became a specialty of his as well. That was not all he spoke about. In the book, I gathered a bunch of tshuvot of his, and it's a major theme of his, but there are other major themes of his as well. But certainly medical questions was something that he became particularly expert in. I find him a fascinating person just because I feel like, from learning something from him, he really straddles this interesting line between what we might call Haredi and what we might call modern or centrist Orthodox, in that many, many, many of the things that he writes confront modernity in this very interesting way, in a way that, as a matter of stereotype, I'm not saying it's true, but as a stereotype, you wouldn't always expect from a certain segment of the Orthodox world. Just as like a factoid, not in his tshuvot, but in the 1950s, when he's in his 30s, he published a 3-volume book called Hilchot Medina, because he believed the state of Israel could run by halacha, and he wrote a book about how it could work. I think his family eventually tried to get it off the market. I got it. Hebrewbooks.org lets you like print books that don't have copyright issues. I got it printed like from them and just sent to me, so I now own it. But it's just an example of who the man, like, he was this very broad thinking person.
Wow. So that's really remarkable. You're saying it's almost like something you would imagine coming from the religious Zionist world, a work like that.
And right. Herzog, for example, does it. Right. Herzog wrote about a state of Medina, but Herzog was the chief rabbi of the state of Israel. The Tzitz Eliezer is really much a step to the right of that, and yet was, at least in his 30s, excited enough about the advent of the state of Israel to spend the time to put that down in writing and to write it.
And it's also a great example of how the modern Orthodox, I'm not sure how you identify. I'll speak for myself. I find myself in the YU modern Orthodox world. I imagine you're somewhat situated there as well. We don't have a monopoly on Torah Ramada. Here you have Rabbi Waldenberg, who really understands, or he's consulting actual physicians and doctors and specialists to inform his tshuva. So this is real Torah Mada here also. And speaking of which, so the tshuva we're doing today is actually from his area of expertise, even though, as you mentioned, he knew Kol HaTorah Kula. But of course, in his capacity at the hospital, he received all sorts of medical ethics questions. And so can you tell us about the medical ethics question that we're going to see in our tshuva right now?
Yes. So the doctor who contacted the Tzitz Eliezer had dealt with this child who was born without significant genitalia. Like she wasn't, so they, I think it's easier in that situation to turn her into a girl, but she wasn't born with anything, he or she wasn't born with anything that would mark them as either gender. So through surgery, they had managed to give her what looked like the genitalia of a woman. So she's now identifying as a woman and halachically counts as a woman, wants to get married, but clearly is not going to be able to have children. There's just not, there's no physical ability to have children. There's no, none of the apparatus of childbearing exists in this woman. And the doctor has the sense that the woman is dating, and it seems like she's dating in a more Haredi world, but I don't know that that's true. But however it's working, she's dating and not planning on revealing to her fiance this fact about her.
Oh,
she's
wow.
Never going to be able to, it's just clear. She's never going to be able to have children. I mean, biologically, never going to be able to have children. She's not revealing to the, and the doctor wants to know, should he tell the guy? Is he allowed to? Is he required to? And remember, the doctors take an oath of confidentiality. So it's A, should I tell? A, you know, what's supposed to happen? And B, what about my oath? So.
Wow. So before we jump into the considerations, and I'm sure you'll summarize for us the halachic slash ethical considerations that the Tzitz Eliezer has to reckon with, I recall that the Tzitz Eliezer also had a two tshuvos at least, where he dealt with issues of children being born without clear genitalia pointing in one direction or the other, or with both. And it gets cited a lot in the gender reassignment discussion. I don't know if this was the same case or it was just another case of someone he had to
deal with. I
don't
know. He doesn't refer to it in the tshuva. He doesn't refer to it in the tshuva.
Okay.
Here it's already been done. But it's already been done. It was done 19 years earlier because this girl is now 19.
Ah, right.
And is dating and is whatever, getting engaged. So he doesn't deal with that part of it in this tshuva at all.
Okay. So
although I will say, one of the remarkable things about the Tzitz Eliezer is he has 26 volumes of tshuvot. That's alone remarkable. But also, he either had a filing system that was unbelievable or a memory that was unbelievable or both, because he will refer back to his tshuvot from volumes earlier. And he'll say, you know, I wrote about this back here, back here, back here, and he'll refer you back to it. And I don't know about you, but when I write something, I have no sense of being able to identify it in those ways. So that itself is just like a fascinating thing to watch.
I mean, that's, you know, it's Chatei Maskera Yom. That's why, that's part of the reason I haven't actually purchased the full set of Tzitz Eliezer yet. I've been cheating and just getting an Otzar HaChachma, because where am I going to put that whole set? Also, they need it once they, I think I'll invest in it once they come out, once they give it a facelift, once they make the Tzur Sadaf a little bit cleaner, because this is what I always fear. Whenever I buy a safer, I'm always afraid that there's going to be an updated version. Oz Vahadar will come out with an annotated edition of it. And then I'll be like, oh my gosh, why did I spend $1,000 on this set? So I have that
I totally
fear.
And the truth is, I'm much more of a computer guy. I'm much more of a computer guy in those terms. Because the truth is, in the early 90s, in the mid 90s, I was a very early adopter of the Bar Ilan because of its searchability. And that actually, this book would have been impossible without it, because I found tshuvot for this book based on the date on which they were written. It was the fact that I could search through the catalog just by a date and find tshuvot that gave me the access to this. So for me, the searchability is a huge factor, a huge upside of all of this.
Absolutely. I think that's a disclaimer I give many times. I was Zocha recently to publish my own Sefer, and people are like, whoa, how do you collect all these sources? And I said, look, I'm just a guy with a basic yeshiva education. Obviously, you're a much bigger Talmud Chacham than I am, but I'm speaking for myself. I know what I'm looking for. I have these computer programs, which cuts down all the time. It still takes work. You know, there's still, I like to think, some on mail list that goes into it, but it's remarkable the tools that we have at our disposal. And it takes, because so much of our, I find for myself, so much of my mental capacity before using those programs really went into just the searching through and my eyes glazing over. And by the time I found the material I wanted, I'm at 10% capacity left. This is amazing. I can use my mental capacity mostly for actually understanding the text that I want to spend my time on. So it's remarkable.
Right.
So, okay, let's jump in. So what are the potential halachic and ethical issues that the Tzitz Eliezer reckons with in solving this question of whether the doctor can break confidentiality to save this potentially huge mistake that's about to happen?
So the big question is the confidentiality one. This man has taken an oath, it seems like, to not reveal information as part of his medical practice. Can he do so? Must he do so? Is he required to do so? So the key piece of the answer, and it's a very important piece of the answer because I think unfortunately people don't realize it. And I've seen other tshuvot with Tzitzil Ezer stressed it, and it was a very important issue to him. He quotes a Pirkei Tshuva, where the Pirkei Tshuva says, everybody talks about Lashon Hara and about not telling Lashon Hara. Mm-hmm. And the Pirkei Tshuva says, but they don't realize there are times when you're required to say things because the Gemara applies the verse. The verse is Lo Ta'amod Al Dam Re'echa. You can't stand by while your friend is being killed, but the Gemara understands that to mean and to apply to any loss that you can help a fellow Jew avoid. So that's the first key thing. If you have information and a fellow Jew is going to lose by virtue of not knowing that information, there's an obligation to tell your fellow Jew. It's part of this obligation. Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa. To me, I think it was particularly important because I know of situations people don't do that. And people think to themselves, I'm not going to step in there. Why would I? You know, I know of marriages that happen that clearly should not have happened, right? And I didn't know at the time they should not have happened. But after the fact, when, you know, when there's a lot of of shrapnel that comes out of a marriage that goes bad, excuse me, when it could have been avoided, but sharing the information. So that to me was a very important point that people think. And he quotes, the Chafetz Chaim says so as well, right? So the fact that Chafetz Chaim built a life on avoiding Lashon Hara, and that the Chafetz Chaim goes out of its way to say, but if it's information that somebody needs that can help them avoid a loss, you have to tell. Mm-hmm. Right? So that I think is the key important thing that Tzitzil Ezer stands up for and stands up vigorously and firmly for it. And he raises the idea. He says, well, you might just say they'll get married, and if he finds out he doesn't want to stay in the marriage, he'll get divorced. So Tzitzil Ezer says, no. And he says no for two vital and important reasons. Reason number one, he says, emotionally, it's not fair to the guy. Right? When you get married, you get invested in the person and you develop a connection with the person. So how far down the road is he going to find out she's infertile? It's not going to happen right away because they can conduct, the way the doctor put her together, they can conduct an ordinary marital life. So what will happen? A year later, she won't have gotten pregnant yet. So what will happen? If she wants to keep up the ruse, she'll say, I'm going to fertility doctors, not working yet. It's this, it's that. By that way down the road, you're in a marriage for 2 years, you have to break up. Second, he says, if she's really so invested in hanging on, she can make his life miserable. Now, we often today speak about the other side of it. Like women were stuck in a marriage because the man won't give them a divorce. And that's worse. But it's not easy if a woman is determined not to get divorced. It's not so easy for the man either. It could take years, right? And then maybe he'll eventually get a heter merabani, which is an advantage that a woman doesn't have, absolutely. He'll get permission, but that can take a while. And then Tzitzil Ezer says, and not everybody wants to be the second wife, knowing that the man is still officially married to somebody else. So all of that, is all of that, it's just not fair to put him into it.
So he, I think he reckons with the question. I mean, this is always the question that comes up whenever someone gets married or enters into any arrangement under false pretenses. The question is, can we invoke mekach tos? Can we say that the kiddushin was never chal? They never got married to begin with because he married under a misunderstanding.
Yeah, he brings that up and he rejects it. He doesn't go. He doesn't tell you how far he would go in rejecting it. He doesn't say you can't do it. He says he doesn't think you'd want to do it. He thinks you'd need a divorce. I think he was leery of it. He doesn't here define the parameters of that. I know people today who are much more comfortable with it. It is absolutely a concept that's out there. And then the parameters of where that is or where that isn't, those are very, very hard. I remember there was a case a few years ago where a man got married to a woman. He told her he was in medical school. And like 3 years later, she finds out he was never in medical school. And he'd been leaving the house every day as if he was going to medical school and whatever. I think there, the poskim told her that as a matter of fact, she didn't have to worry about it. It's a very hard question. He seems very, very leery, very cautious, and very unwilling to just dismiss marriages that way. It's a big deal, dismiss marriage that way, because the whole world knows of the marriage, and then all of a sudden they'll see her as if she's unmarried. We don't want people getting the impression that you can just walk away from marriage. So it's a very big problem. He doesn't define it well here. He just says here he doesn't think that's what you would do. He doesn't exactly say why.
Right. It sounds almost, maybe I'm reading into it too much, almost like a policy consideration, which is even in theory, if a certain situation could qualify for mekach tos, it really throws the whole institution of marriage into jeopardy. The idea that we could retroactively revoke marriages. I know this question very heartbreakingly also gets brought up in terms of when a woman marries a man and she finds out he's gay, or a man marries a woman and finds out that she's lesbian. And certainly if that person was already aware of that same-sex attraction before marriage. Also, I think Rav Willig, if I'm not mistaken, I think in Am Mordechai, he reckons with that topic, if that's also grounds for Mekach Tos. And these are all heartbreaking cases. And the question is it enough to reach that threshold that we can use Mekach Tos?
Right. So that's the thing. So there's this clear standard that turns out not to be so clear. And then, as you said, there's the policy question too. Right? The standard is, if you get married and it's something which it's clear that the other partner would not have accepted, and then as soon as they find out about it, they say, I'm not accepting this, I'm walking away, then they're allowed to walk away because it is a – meaning Mekach Tos comes from the business world, right? If I buy something for you and it turns out you're selling me something fraudulent, it's not a transaction. It was fraudulent. So here too, that's the question. Like you said, what rises to the level of fraudulent? That's a very complicated question, right? Here too. So for example, the end of the tshuva is – I'll get to the very end in a second because I think it's Sicilians are being very sensitive in a very interesting way. But the upshot of the tshuva is the young man has to know. But that doesn't mean he has to walk away, even though theoretically you could say he's not allowed to marry her because he doesn't have children yet. He has an obligation to have children. Sicilia does not say that. He says the man has to know so he can make his own decision. He can ask Rabban and he can ask his own post about what he should do about that situation. But he has to have the information. But once you say that, it means you can imagine a world in which he would marry her anyway. So that's what makes the Mekach Tos conversation a little harder. Right, if a woman's going to marry a man who turns out to be gay, and he's never going to, and there's no solution there of any whatsoever, you might argue that there it's much clearer that she would never have gotten into a marriage like that. Right. Here, it's somewhat less clear.
So I wonder almost. It's not inherently the issue of her being infertile, incapable of bearing children, but it's almost that she was duplicitous. And seemingly duplicitous by withholding such critical information, like that would be the psul, is the lack of forthrightness.
I'm not sure that makes something automatically a Mekach Tos. I'm not sure that we would say that. Because I think there are people who marry people who know that they're keeping, they keep some secrets and they think it's enough secrets, whatever it is. I actually just heard of a case, I don't know the case intimately, I just heard of a case recently where a couple is having tremendous problems now because it turns out there was something in her past that is not obviously a reason you wouldn't get married, but she didn't reveal it. And the guy's saying, it was so duplicit of you, this is terrible. But here, that doesn't seem to be an issue. Here, it seems to be the fertility itself that's the issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And maybe because it could be, I don't know, this is me speculating, it could be because in that world, it's perfectly understandable why she's being duplicit about it. Because she fears she'll never get a shidduch. So it could be that piece of it is not the piece of it that would upset him. It would be the fact that he's not going to have children of his own now by staying with her.
Right. Certainly, especially it's compounded in even like a more traditional setting where the childbearing is even more critical and central to the whole.
Correct.
The marriage is the hechi timsa for peri of Arivia in order to bring about the children. So the stakes are much higher. And this is a question, I mean, there's been books written on this. I think they came out one from Rechaim Kanievsky's Psakim on Shidduchim recently. I was in Muncie and I saw it there. There's whole books written on the whole question of shilas that come up in Shidduchim. And the main question, of course, in the literature in general has been about how much information do you have to reveal? If someone is, you know, was sexually active before marriage, before dating this person, do they have to reveal that was something that occurred? Do they have to tell them something like that? Yeah, and there's a question from a halachic standpoint, and then there's a question from the marriage counseling standpoint. And I mean, I personally, you know, I stay away from that because I don't have formal counseling training. And I always get, this is just my little, I get a bit of a kick out of it. I see a lot of, there are pulpit rabbis who have the training to do it, but I find many times people like me. So the second we get smicha and we're married, we say, I'm married and I have smicha. Now I have a right to dispense marital advice. That's not part of my training. So, I'm sticking within the halachic realm over here. So this is... So this is a question that gets asked a lot in the literature, and it's a question that not just doctors have to deal with, but Rabbanim and friends and family have to ask as well. This is, of course, I think the stakes here to a certain degree are compounded and are higher because you said the doctor takes an oath, and if I remember correctly, in the tshuva, he said the oath is not so easily broken. What does he have to do in order to actually break this oath?
So,
or is he breaking the oath?
So that's two good questions. Ritzitzel does not think the oath would have applied to this circumstance on its own, because there's a general principle that if a Jew has a Torah obligation to do something or not to do something, and they take an oath the other way, the oath doesn't take effect, because we're mushba v'omeid mehar Sinai, because we've already at Sinai agreed to do otherwise, and therefore it doesn't take effect. So if the doctor had only taken an oath not to reveal this information, he wouldn't have to worry about it, because that's not a valid oath. But the oath the doctor takes is to treat people, do this, do that. That oath applies to many permissible and proper situations, so it's a valid oath. And once it's a valid oath, it might include this circumstance in it, because it's taken effect. So therefore, the Tzitzit Ezra actually says he thinks the man is to a Hataras Nedarim. So Hataras Nedarim, we always think of Hataras Nedarim as like, you know, before Yom Kippur, you go in front of people, just say something. That's not what he means. What he means is you go to an actual important rabbi who will gather two other people with him, and they'll actually talk about, you know, that the man had not realized the situation would face him, and therefore he was erroneous. Another example of tulps, right? The underlying meaning of Ataras Nedarim is that you realize that your oath was taken without proper understanding of what you were committing to, and then you're mad to the neder, and then he could tell. But then, I don't know if you wanted to ask about this, but then the kicker, I think, is the Sicilian then says to him, but I don't think you should tell him right away. I think you should go to the girl and tell her you have an obligation to tell, but it would be better if she told and advise her to tell. Meaning, Sicilian is hoping, because Sicilian, I think, thinks that there's a chance that if a couple are dating, they're already engaged and they've already got a certain kind of a relationship, maybe the man will ask his rabbi, and the rabbi will say, yeah, get married, and it'll be a big kindness of you to marry her, and you'll maybe adopt children, or you'll find some other way to do it, whatever it is, however you work out the halachic issues. But if it comes from her, like you said, at least the duplicitous part will go away, and then it'll be more about this issue, and can this man imagine marrying this woman who has, you know, she's got plenty of good things about her, she just has this one thing about it that's a problem, and can you do it? So I thought that was a very interesting piece of advice at the end.
Yeah, that's excellent. I would think that's excellent interpersonal advice. Again, who am I to appraise these things? But it makes sense, because right. Now you're giving them a shot at salvaging their relationship. Correct. You know, exactly. And if she's not willing to, then the doctor has to take the nuclear option and go ahead and inform him, because l'sam al adam reyacha, he has an obligation to not just stand by while he is being harmed emotionally and being tricked in this way. So that's right. A really fascinating point. And something that interests me, the whole Hataras Nedarim, it's interesting because that means we're acknowledging when the doctors take what's called the Hippocratic Oath. Is that what it's called? So
yeah, although I think Jewish doctors take the Maimonidean version of the oath.
We're giving religious, you know, we're acknowledging religious significance and binding of this oath. So because he has to do Hataras Nedarim.
Absolutely. We do that all the time, though, because I remember actually in the book, I mean, so the book doesn't summarize the Tshuvot. If you wanted to see summaries of all the Tshuvot that I did them in audio shiurim on the OU website. It's called The Response of the Day. So there's 300 and whatever something audio shiurim there. And then I summarize many of them in writing at a website where I publish twice a week called TorahMusings.com. And then whatever. And then I think on academia, I think I have the others, whatever it is. But there's a Tshuva of the Notabi Yehuda who's living in the late 1700s. Who was asked about whether Jews could lie in non-Jewish court. And he says, absolutely not, right? So the answer is, if a Jew says, I swear, right? That's why Jews sometimes affirm rather than swearing. Because if you say, I swear, that's like an oath d'oraita, and has all of the severity of violating. And remember that in Shavuot, we say, if people lie falsely, that's seen as much worse than an ordinary violation of prohibition in the Torah. So yeah, I think that anytime a Jew says I swear to something, that means they've committed to it. And if it's a valid Shavua oath at a Jewish from a Jewish perspective, it obligates just like a regular Jewish oath. So
wow.
Yeah.
So that's a really important point, that just because we might find ourselves in a secular or non-Jewish religious context, it doesn't mean that what we do doesn't have religious implications.
Exactly. Correct. For sure. Right. Yeah.
And so I'm glad that you already, by the way, talked about your book and your writings and Torah musings. I'm a big fan. Rabbi Gilstein has let me publish a little bit on there, but you're far more prolific than I am on Torah musings and beyond.
Well, I don't do anything else.
I've been reading your material. I'm a fan. I think every other article on Torah musings has been authored by you. Is there anything else just about this tshuva, about its reception, about its broader implications that you wanted to share, and also any additional ways that people can learn Torah from you that we should be aware of?
So
you already mentioned
first
a lot
about the tshuva. First about the tshuva. I just feel like it's a point that's made, like he makes it. He's got 26 volumes. I did not see nearly that many of his tshuva. I saw, 60, 70 of his tshuva, which is not nothing, but I saw him talk about it twice already. Just this idea that people, I think it's an important point. People pick up on a religious requirement and then they forget about equal religious requirements. People are like, Lashon Hara, I don't want to say that. I don't want to ruin that shidduch. Like, what do I know? But sometimes you know stuff. And that's true in business as well, right? Somebody's getting into it. I don't remember why it came up, but I was, Googling, you go down these wormholes and somebody's name came up from the neighborhood. And I was trying to figure out, who is this person? I know something about them. I look it up and it turns out there's this major lawsuit between a man, his now ex-wife, and some other person, Jew, or all Orthodox Jews from my neighborhood who I know, about some money that went wrong, that went bad. Right. So imagine before they got into that deal, I knew that this guy is not somebody you should be trusting. Wow. And I just said, before you get involved in that deal, you might want to think twice, because I think that at least now, you'll say to me, well, just because somebody went wrong once doesn't mean he can never do business again, and that's true as well. But the idea of caution, the idea of people being, when Jews have information, they should be sharing it. And it's, I think, sometimes easy to opt for the frommer version. Oh, I don't tell Lashon Hara. And it feels like you're being so, so Orthodox and so religious when you do that. And so I thought that was a very important point. Still, Ezra is battling against that idea and saying it's not true.
Yeah, so I think I've seen it in recent years. This Pisrei Tshuva has been really cited. Unfortunately, we've seen a lot of public abuse cases in which there were people who were otherwise, until that point, reputable rabbis who were convicted of abusing other people and minors, Rachmana Litzlan. And this Pisrei Tshuva was a very important source, which is, on the one hand, we have the value of Lashon Hara. On the other hand, there's also Lo Sama L'Adam Re'echa, that you can't just stand idly by when you have important information. And I think the struggle...
And sadly, in a lot of those cases, it's multiple times in multiple venues.
Right.
They go from one job to the next job, and you say, I don't want to stop from getting a job.
Right. And I think what's so fraught about it is that there's the competing considerations when it's not as clearly substantiated. On one hand, like, we need to save people. We can't just let him go take another position there. He's going to harm more people if that's what's been happening. But on the other hand, if someone's too trigger happy and hasn't done their homework, then once you make a claim against someone, you've basically irrevocably ruined their life, even in theory, if they're legally exonerated. So this Pisrei Tshuva is like a very important, it's very important just and very fraught. But it teaches us that we can't always just lazily sit back and say, Lashon Hara, I can't get involved. Sometimes, like in this case, it's Tzitzel Yezer, and certainly Rachman Eltzon in the cases we just mentioned with abuse, there's an imperative that one needs to be able to speak up to save others from being harmed.
And the Chofetz Chaim agreed.
I'm glad
Chofetz Chaim said so himself. And the Chofetz Chaim said so himself. I mean, I think
that's what's truly remarkable.
Right. Wow. Exactly.
Well, Rabbi Rothstein, I really appreciate your time. And again, for our listeners, you should check out his new book, Judaism of the Poskim, which outlines and summarizes I have to get hold of the book, by the way, myself. It's Chatim Askeryom. I'll go order it.
I can send you a copy.
So Judaism of the Poskim, which actually, since if you're listening to this podcast, you probably are interested in Shalos HaTshuvos. So this is literally a book that gives you a tshuva for every day of the year. So I couldn't think of a better choice for our listeners. Rabbi Rothstein, a true schus to have you. Please continue to be Marbitz Torah and to share your wisdom with all of Klal Yisrael. Thank you for coming on the show, and wishing you all the best.
Thank you so much for having me, and to you as well. Thanks so much.
Take care. Thank you for listening to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Please make sure to subscribe to get the latest updates. And if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to rate us and leave a review. Do you have a response to the response that you want to share on the show? Please send your letter to the editor to MitchellMKurtz@gmail.com. And God willing, we would love to consider your perspective to be shared on a future episode. This is Moshe Kurtz, and I look forward to reviewing more responses with you next time on Shoot First, Ask Questions Later.